Chapter 1. Think.
If you look around you, you'd probably agree that the world is more innovative than ever. It used to be that technology required huge office buildings just to hold it all. And now that same technology fits in the palm of your hand. Most wristwatches or television remotes, they have more functions than most human beings can even remember. And many of the diseases that we used to think were once incurable are now almost on their way to being wiped out. It's clear that our imagination, our ideas, and our discoveries continue to flood the planet in ways no one would have imagined, and it's happening at blinding speed. Big-time excitement is being created as inventors and entrepreneurs all over the world breathe life into brand new inventions, new ideas. They pioneer new businesses never before thought of. In fact, globally, every hour, 101 new patents are applied for, and roughly 2,200 new businesses are started every day. And these entrepreneurs do it with an expectation that they're going to succeed and that the money's just going to come pouring in. Even despite the roller coaster ride of an unpredictable economy, there's a strong sense of confidence. In fact, if you ask these entrepreneurs, nearly 81% of them are optimistic about their prospects for success. It's the kind of optimism you would expect with the positive, strong beliefs they have about their own ideas. They think they're going to hit the market and grab the honors and success for introducing the latest hot new product. And no one can just sit back casually and watch either. Long-time or well-established companies, they're being pushed by fierce competition. They have to break new ground with new products and services constantly to stay ahead. They have to stay fresh. They have to do something that will give them a competitive edge or something that will stop or keep their market share from eroding because there's plenty of new competitors hoping to gobble some up and hope they go unnoticed. Although we've grown pretty accustomed to it, we are witnessing one of the greatest innovation explosions in history. Things are pretty good. And for a lot of the products or businesses that you bump into, sometimes you kind of slap yourself in the head and say, that's a cool idea. Why didn't I think of that?
And see, Dave, I can dig the innovation explosion. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. And unfortunately, as we kind of parade the innovation down the street, there's a heavy dose of rain that's about to come down on it.
Yeah, if it was just about innovation, we wouldn't need to be concerned about it.
Right. There's another part of the equation. While it's cool that people are optimistic and inventive and innovative, and there's no doubt that the economy would suffer without it, it's also true that the innovation explosion gets set up by a business implosion. Because as quickly as those ideas Dave talked about pop up, and as rapidly as new companies open their doors for business, failure takes them down just as fast. For example, by the time you finish listening to just this section of the audio, 46 new businesses will shut their doors, and 3 of them will file for bankruptcy. And by the end of today, 2,100 new businesses will follow their lead. See, that is a ruthless counterattack to the innovation explosion, and it's not just the startups. The same thing happens to big companies. All you have to do is pick up the Wall Street Journal or check the headlines on CNN, whatever you're reading, and you can watch the blow-by-blow account. Minute by minute, companies admit poor financial performance. And then guess what they do? They follow it with layoffs or restructuring or whatever to try to make up for the losses. And basically, in a lot of cases, it's the corporate equivalent of facelifts or liposuction. I mean, it's not exactly a good diet and exercise in the business world. See, here's the other part of the equation that we talked about earlier. Equal to the number of good ideas being cranked out every day, every minute, is the unleashing of a whole lot of bad ideas. I mean, for example, have you ever eaten Cracker Jack cereal or had a really bad headache and thought, where's the Bengay aspirin? See, even as we say those things, and as you hear them, they have the ring of something that's just gonna bomb. But somebody somewhere in some meeting thought, hey, cool idea, let's do it. They thought it would work. And that's kind of our point. There are a massive amount of people and ideas that get onto the ballot and get into the Bad Idea Hall of Fame. And whatever it is that we're doing right now is getting us the same kind of results we've been getting for decades. So even when you have an innovative idea and you're optimistic and excited and entrepreneurial about it, it still doesn't guarantee an open for business sign on the front door.
So why do so many good ideas or products fail? I suppose you could ask the other question, why do so many bad ideas make it into production? How come innovation doesn't guarantee success, and why do bright, determined entrepreneurs continue to fall way short? I mean, ideas continue to heat up while business continues to melt down. We ought to start asking the question, what gives?
And here's what gives. Here's what caves in on us. Our thinking. See, the results we get come directly from the choices that every single one of us make about what gets our time and attention. And at some point, given the fact that you have an unlimited number of choices and a very limited amount of time, you decide to do some things and then you let others go. And the question becomes, are you letting the right things go? Are you paying attention to the things that really work? Because effectiveness is often driven as much by the things that we don't do and should as the things that we actually do and shouldn't. And what you decide to do and don't do is ultimately driven by your thinking. See, your thinking created the decision, and your decision launched a whole bunch of activity or projects and initiatives. That's why thinking is the nucleus of business. It drives what actually gets created and launched. It's like the blueprint, the DNA in our head. And whatever follows it is only as good as our thinking. That's why it's like the Big Bang in business. It sets everything else that follows it in motion. So if you want to change your results, you have to change your thinking.
That won't be an easy task. I mean, what do we do today? We meet, we strategize, we meet again. We analyze risks, send emails, make phone calls. We meet again. We write memos. Most people are just going through the motions of doing business, not thinking business. How is what they do even connected to what they produce? Now, for most people, what they do is not what makes them productive in their work. Guessing what to change in your activities, whether it's meetings, emails, memos, rearranging people, restructuring org charts, whatever. Very often it only provides the illusion of progress, but it doesn't hold out much hope for better output or even faster output. Output is driven by the activities people engage in. Deciding what activities to be engaged in, that's all based on thinking. Whether they're the right activities or whether they are done efficiently becomes less important than the first decision of what should be done. Stripped down to its essentials, the motion and movement of business today is thinking. You get paid to think. It's the crucial common thread that weaves its way throughout the fabric of every department or team, every division, and even the boardroom. Thinking through what you could do and then deciding what you should do is the essential distinction we have to start making. People might be able to get more efficient by rearranging activities, but to become more effective requires a change in thinking itself.
So if what Dave's saying is true, that thinking is the new face of work, how will you know if you're successful? How would you measure the success of people in your company who are thinking? The first step would be to somehow track those decisions. Because if decisions are the result of your thinking, let's go back to the decision DNA and find out how well it holds up. And that will give you the first indication of how productive you are, how productive anyone is. One guy actually did track the decisions from people's thinking. His name's Paul Nutt. He's a professor at Ohio State's Fisher College of Business. And over the last 19 years, he watched executives and managers decide at 356 different companies. Of all the decisions that he tracked, more than 50% failed. They were either quickly abandoned, they were only partially implemented, or they were never even adopted at all. So while that may be pretty alarming, we think the reason those decisions fail is even scarier. More than 130 of the decisions reflected an egotistical take-charge approach. And even for the egotistical approach, only 42% of those decisions were adopted and barely a handful worked. When it comes to executives, nearly two-thirds never explored any alternative once they made up their mind. 81% of managers and executives push their decisions through by persuasion or by their sheer force of will or their political power, their position, whatever. Persuasion failed 53% of the time, and edict failed 65% of the time. And they failed not only because those decisions lacked sound thinking, but because people resent heavy-handed, manipulative tactics, even when the decision has merit. And here's the thing that actually surprised Dave and I most. Only 7% of the decisions were made after considering long-term priorities or conferring with colleagues anywhere else in the organization. So the question is, does that surprise you? Put yourself in that study. If Paul Nutt watched you work and followed you around in the daily routine of your business as you're thinking and deciding, and then asked you, before he showed you the results of his study, how many of your business decisions fail, or how many of your initiatives collapse, would you answer him, half? We wouldn't. As a matter of fact, if you were asked on a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being, I can't believe someone actually pays me to think, and 10 being, yeah, people occasionally worship at the altar of my business brilliance, how would you rate your confidence as a business decision maker? So here comes the bizarre, weird twist in all of this. If you answered somewhere even remotely close to people worship me, then you're with the in crowd. Because 91% of your colleagues said the same thing. In fact, in a recent survey, over 800 managers and professionals were asked the question if the quality of their business decisions over the past 3 years had improved. And 91% of them said their confidence had increased or stayed the same. Think about that, increased or stayed the same. So in other words, here's the bottom line. Over 50% of our decisions fail one way or the other, and even though we're failing, 91% of us are as confident as ever in our ability to make those decisions. That is what you might call a gap. I mean, gap's an understatement. It's the Grand Canyon. We've been in business, all of us. We've watched the gap. We've helped create the gap. And it's still hard to believe that we're losing that much. In fact, it's pretty surprising that as long as we've been doing this business thing, since the Industrial Revolution, that we're not a lot better at it by now. And whether we want to believe it or not, the statistics show that half of all our decisions are failing, and half of all of our projects don't turn out as we hoped for or we wished. There is a gigantic chasm between ideas and results. And if we want to change the results, we have to close the gap. We have to change our thinking. Every person in every company has to close it, has to change. At least bridge it a little bit. Here's just one case in point of living or dying by what we think. It's how some bad thinking can wipe out an original cool idea for a business. And the business was a grocery delivery service called Webvan. They're now bankrupt. Webvan had this great service. The people who delivered your orders from online grocery shopping were polite. They were knowledgeable. They actually brought the groceries you ordered and showed up exactly when they said they would. Pay attention, cable companies. It would seem to us that this is exactly how business is supposed to work. These people were business thinking. Good prices, great service, delivery of what you actually ordered. Unfortunately, as a shareholder, what you could also count on was the mental flatlining that took place for some of the people at the very top. Stuart Alsop, who writes for Fortune magazine, wrote a great article describing kind of what happened with Webvan, and he also happened to be a shareholder, so it has kind of that unique perspective. Here's what he said. At a time when Webvan had just 2 quarters worth of cash in the bank, the company started repainting all of its brightly colored vans. So after less than 2 years of operations, Webvan decided to launch a rebranding campaign. Rebranding? The company's brand was barely established in the minds of its few customers. The company was running out of money, and raising more money was getting harder every day. Yet management decided to get the vans repainted. I'm sure the amount was small, perhaps less than $100,000, but that was cash out the door. Cash that could never be used for any purpose. Which illustrates one reason WebBan failed. There were no real entrepreneurs running this company. Real entrepreneurs never let money out the door, for any reason, that doesn't strictly advance the business of the company. My wife and I wish WebVan had spent money on improving the website rather than repainting its vans. We wish management had spent that money learning what we wanted from our purchases. Had they done so, they could have charged us higher fees for tailored services. We wish they had experimented more with shorter delivery times or larger ordering windows or any other operational changes that would lead to greater efficiency. I wish this wasn't such a sad, sad tale. WebVan management squandered nearly $1 billion of very cheap capital.
If you took a look around, it would seem pretty obvious that it's not just WebVan that's guilty of doing some mental flatlining. Everyone does their fair share of mental flatlining or repainting vans. Nobody's perfect. In fact, early in my career, someone told me, making mistakes is not failure. Not learning from those mistakes is failure. Now, since we all make mistakes, it seems pretty easy to buy into that idea. But the truth of the matter is, there are serious consequences to us not making good decisions. It's no longer sufficient to chalk this up to the mental easy escapes of, hey, no pain, no gain, or if you're not failing, you must not be trying anything new. Sooner or later, we have to face up to the fact that our collective history in business is loud and clear. We're not learning from our mistakes. It's just not okay to keep doing the same things over and over and over again and keep expecting different results. See, the challenge is the cold hard numbers show that there is a huge gap that separates us from the results we want and need and those that we're actually getting. According to research, business people aren't just in trouble, they're also in denial. Needless to say, the price we pay for mental flatlining as companies is very high, and there's clearly a need for a revolution in business thinking. It's long overdue. If we could just get the results that we want to match the extraordinary level of our confidence, it will make a dramatic difference. Now, here's the only problem. The odds for success are squarely on the side of failure. Author Gary Hamel puts it this way: people have been trained to think in ways that fit the industrial age, not the post-industrial age. We have to rewire people with new thinking skills. And it's up to you to beat the odds against you. You'll have to work hard at rewiring your own thinking, and at least one fundamental belief will have to change before the rewiring can really be effective. It used to be pretty common that all rights of thinking were kind of assigned to the boss or those in upper management, and it was assumed or maybe pretended that he or she, which usually was a he, was the only one with enough management savvy and experience to think. And because they were in the position and had upper management support, well, they must have proven themselves as one of the select few that had unequaled problem-solving ability. So everyone else was just supposed to carry out their orders. Well, that's not the case anymore. What used to be somebody's job is now everybody's job. You have just as much responsibility as the CEO to think. And if you are the CEO, everyone in your company has just as much responsibility to think as you do, and maybe more. Although you may not recognize or think of yourself as a business person, you are a business person. And by the way, all unrivaled, unquestioned business intelligence doesn't reside in the boardroom. The square footage in someone's office, the title on their door, where they get to park, or the size of their salary does not guarantee good thinking.
And the real bummer is that there are a whole bunch of managers and companies that don't pay people to think. They pay them, or they hope, or they expect them to agree with them. I mean, it's often just built into the company culture. Everybody thinks the same way. To borrow an old Pink Floyd phrase, everybody's comfortably numb. To really enable people to think business, there has to be a manifest respect for everybody in the company as business people. If everyone is business thinking, then they will be worthy of the respect. Without it, you get things like the red tape police. They are a bunch of people that run around in the organization, creating additional requirements for the people who are incompetent, and they're creating the same kind of barricades for the talented, competent people who can't get around them and spend more time trying to get around red tape and politics than delivering value for the company. So if you can change the way you think and build a common, optimized approach for unleashing the potential of human technology, what's in your head, then you can rub out the red tape police and change the fundamental nature of the work that you're doing to get the results that you expect in the first place. It's scary to think about the failure that we've just been coasting with. It's even scarier when you consider the fact that that failure success is pretty much unpredictable and random. Everyone seems to have their own standard, their own rules for making decisions. As a matter of fact, almost 90% of business people say there is no common approach, no common criteria for making decisions where they work. And in the absence of something, anything, people make up their own rules. So the next time you're in your company and you're walking around and you look inside a meeting, if it looks like the people are playing the game rock, paper, scissors, don't bother them. They're making a decision. That's what it feels like. In our companies, you have about a 1/3 chance of making the right decision, and there's no way to change the odds. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So we at least have a good shot at changing the odds. Dave and I are setting out these 8 rules to get it right, whatever it is for you. Marketing, finance, sales, operations, innovation, it doesn't matter what it is, the rules apply.